This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. You know, for families, the start of the school year often spells end of summer dread for kids and sweet relief for parents. But this school year, things are a little different. When daily routines have radically shifted because of the COVID-19 pandemic and the Delta variant adds a new level of complexity and anxiety. Today, we complete this week's Back to School series, beginning with WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. She has got her ear to the ground talking to teachers, parents, administrators, and more about how they are navigating all of this. Now, later, we will check in with a school nurse as she gears up for the new school year. But first, Carrie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tiziana. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. So, Carrie, we have heard from two educators already this week. I know you spend a lot of time talking to parents and families. So how about them? What are you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some mixed feelings out there among parents. And sometimes, depending on where you fall, they can be strong feelings. There's this group of parents who are like not only excited to have their kids back in school, but they feel really strongly that their kids return without a mask mandate. I know I've heard several of them protesting outside of recent state board of education meetings, so they feel very strongly. You also have a lot of families who fall down the middle who feel like schools are being pretty safe, and you know, they also feel good about the effectiveness of masks. And then you also have parents on the other side who are really, really nervous about this upcoming school year, especially parents with kids who are either too young to get vaccinated, or maybe they have someone with a comorbidity in their house. So it can really, really vary.
So most schools are returning fully in person this year, Carrie. There's a growing patchwork of local and then state mandates to help that happen safely. Are parents mostly on board, or are some seeking alternatives?
Well, I would say parents are mostly on board with mask mandates. You know, there is a very vocal contingency of people out there who equate mask mandates to child abuse, but this statewide directive about masks was pretty widely supported. Now, that being said, we are seeing an uptick in parents who are, you know, still very nervous about going back to school, and they're looking into some homeschooling options this year, or opting for the virtual schools that are already exist in the state. And when I say virtual schools, I mean the ones that have existed before COVID. There were two of them. They've been around since the early 2010s. And this year, there's a wait list of about 1,000 students between the two of them that are out there.
So we have talked to the superintendent of Chelsea Schools. We talked to her yesterday. On this virtual schools thing, they are one of only 7 districts with a virtual school this year. Do we know more about virtual schooling, how it's set to unfold these new virtual schools?
Yeah, you know, so I listened to that interview with Superintendent Abeda yesterday, and, she was saying that it's something that they're going to start small with and kind of learn and go from there. And I think that's what we're going to see going forward among other districts that were approved to have a virtual school, and maybe even, you know, if that number ends up growing. One of the surprising findings that came out of this great remote learning experiment during the pandemic is that some students actually thrive in that environment. So I think educators will continue to use what they learned from the last year and a half and try to build on it.
So you follow teachers' unions too, Carrie. They were really active in pushing for mandatory COVID vaccinations for all public school employees and eligible students. The governor has issued a statewide vaccine mandate for public employees, but it doesn't include teachers. Is that the top priority for teachers' unions right now? And if not, what is?
I mean, it's definitely among the top concerns. I know negotiations are going on for a lot of teachers' unions. The Boston Teachers Union has also, you know, been working to negotiate a new contract. So by and large, though, this concern around whether it's vaccinations or masks, et cetera, it's around workplace safety. I've also seen a lot of talk among union members about pushing for better ventilation in their old building. So also in Boston, you know, outside of that workplace safety kind of realm, the union is also making student needs a top priority. One thing they're pushing for has been, you know, for the district to provide extra support staff for students that both have a disability and have an English learning need.
So just briefly, Governor Baker has said He's hesitant to impose something like a statewide vaccine mandate in schools, wanting to keep that at the local level. Do you anticipate that changing, or how do you think that push and pull could play out as the school year goes on?
Ooh, I would love to tell you I could predict that, especially given all of the surprises that that the COVID pandemic has thrown our way. I think a lot of school leaders and even policymakers were anticipating that after the vaccines came out last spring and were widely available, you know, a lot of the concern about COVID safety would diminish, is what people were hoping for, at least. But the Delta variant has really dramatically changed the game. And so I think some of the decisions about when something should be left to local control versus being state mandated, it's still going to be somewhat political now. It did take the Baker administration quite a while to institute a mask mandate across the public school system. You know, they said it first, that's a local decision. It needs to stay local, and change their mind. So in theory, state leaders say a lot that they like to leave as much as they can up to local control, but they are taking hard lines on things too, you know, just like not having virtual options in a lot of district schools. So it depends on the issue, and I think it depends on the political pressure behind it.
Okay, Carrie, sit tight for a few, please. We'll come back to you, but I want to introduce another voice. We caught up this morning with Marta Bozmer, a school nurse at Boston Green Academy, which is a 6-12 school in Brighton. Marta's first day of school is next week, but they are in the building and getting ready. I started by asking her how she's feeling about this return to school.
I think mixed emotions, mixed feelings. I think on one end, I have just seen the importance of having kids in school, and I do know what that means. It's like a huge ask, but it's so important. It's like vital. So I'm feeling excited to try to get it going again and, you know, kind of go with it, right? Roll with the punches and see if we can make this work. But I'm also a little nervous, you know, COVID and Delta variant kind of increasing the numbers of kids is a little worrisome, but I think I'm ready.
With the policies that are in place, do you feel like it's as safe an environment as it can be to bring kids back into the buildings?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, as a nurse, I just live by policies. I actually love a policy, you know, just this is what you do and this is why. This is why this is here, and understanding just how important safety, health and safety is like number one. I saw Boston Public do so many great things last year in just trying to make it work and trying to make it happen. I think the only concern I would have is, from what I've seen so far, everything really just lined up with what we had last year, except for I think they're working on having each school have a medical waiting room. That's the one thing I can say for sure is something that I think every school needs that we don't actually have in place just yet. It was a recommendation by DESE, I think, at the end of July. So hopefully every school can, if it's not a mandate, they can at least put it in place. Each school should have one of those. So medical waiting room is the one thing that I think for policies just needs to be set up so it's ready to go for next week for first day.
And just to clarify, DESE is Department, elementary and secondary education.
Correct. Yep.
All right. So as you're looking ahead to next week, Marta, is there a student, a kid in particular, who's kind of in your mind as the symbol of who's coming back and the experience you want them to have?
Oh, I love that you said that. Yes. Yeah, I can picture. So my daughter went here. She's a graduate, 2020, probably the hardest year to graduate from high school, I think, ever. So when I think about her class and them not being able to be in the building for all these huge life moments, I then picture every other senior that's coming back in. And I like love these kids. A lot of them were here from sixth grade, so I really know them. Mm. And I can see like 20 of them right now. I know how bad they want to be here. So I want them to be here, but to feel like they're safe here, and that their families feel that they're safe here. So I know my job is to really focus on that. Well, I want them to have a good time and be in school and have it feel like the norm. I know it's not the norm, but I would like to pretend a little bit that they can feel that way and be here. And I can definitely picture, it's just like huge smiles. When kids come in, they're just, it's like, oh my gosh, I miss you so much. That happens right away.
That's so great. So as a nurse, you are in the epicenter of the experience we're having. Can you kind of compare and contrast for me what your workday pre-pandemic was like and what it's like now to work as a school nurse?
You know, pre-pandemic was a lot less stress. You know, definitely lots of visits to the nurse. You know, you see in a little bit of everything. But there was a lot more comfort in being able to spend time and more time with kids. Because, like, part of being a nurse, especially a school nurse, is building trust, building relationships. And, you know, like, you're a kid in my office, you're the only kid in the world. And when COVID happened, it took that away from me. I think it took away from every nurse in schools. You know, you didn't have that comfort level. You certainly weren't displaying that to a student, but you could feel it on the inside. It was different. Different care. You're delivering a different level of care, I think, for yourself. Like, I can rest my head at night on the pillow really well, knowing that I've worked really hard that day. And I feel like I changed kids for the better. I changed the world a little bit. I do think school nurses do that. And I do know that it feels like that still, but on a whole other level. It's like this community level I can appreciate because I am like this point person, right? Like, everything COVID in the school, every question, every family member, every staff, every student, it's like they're coming to me. Because I'm a medical professional, not necessarily a COVID professional, but you kind of become that, you know, whether you want it or not, it's here. So I think what I know of nurses is that we want to know stuff. We want information. So research, just listening to everything you can, knowing what's going on, trends, that's a part of your daily life now. That was not like that before COVID.
With all that responsibility, and maybe I'm assuming, but I feel like I'm hearing from you that you are somebody who really wants to serve. So with all of that demand on you to be of service, how are you keeping yourself whole and healthy and buoyed? And how will you do that this year?
I just had this conversation with my wife last night. I got home last night and I said, right when I got home, I said, you know, I really got to focus on keeping work at work and home is home. I got three kids, two little ones at the house, and I could feel the stress of work in my home all the time. So I think just being cognizant of that, right, and thinking about that, I went home and I said, we were going to check in, me and her, and I said, you know, I'm going to do a little breathing exercise for a couple minutes and then I'll come up. And honestly, I idle on high is what people say about me. I'm ready to go. And that was a change for me to do that. And my wife loved it too. And just being, you know, aware of that every day is, I'm sure it'll be a challenge for me some days, but I think it's important. I want my family to feel like, not feel the stress I feel at work, for sure. You know, but I need that too. And I definitely realize that balance. And then the summer, you know, I had this wonderful summer of just kind of having a break from it all. And it almost felt so necessary to recharge in a way that gave me the time to think about that. So, like, just really appreciate that I had that time to see that I needed that so bad. So I feel like I'm ready, but I got to remember to do that. And everybody's got to remember that. Teachers, everybody. Because school's different, for better or for worse. You know, it is what it is. We just have to take care of ourselves, I think, in a better way.
So you are a mom. Any kids of your own headed into primary school this week, next week?
Yeah, you know, I have, so my oldest, 19, she's at college, Mass College of Art. So I'm on their webpage looking at all their rules and regulations around COVID all the time. And I have two little ones, six-year-old. She is in a nature-based school in the Blue Hills. And my youngest three, he's going into Boston Nature School, which is part of the Mass Audubon. So I'm definitely nervous. There's a part of me that feels like super lucky that I have my kids in this sort of more outdoor school than the traditional public school that I'm working in, right? But it's still, you know, it's there for me still. I'm still worried. But I do have some sense of security that they're outside a little more, so that, I don't know, somehow that calms me a little bit.
You are somebody who will experience both sides of this year. What do you want and need from the families of the kids who are coming into Boston Great Academy this year?
Oh, wow. Thank you for that question. The first thought that comes to mind is just communication. Just telling us what's going on. COVID plays into everything. It plays into the school. It plays into all these environments, your teams, your sports, your work, your job, you know, your friends, anyone that's coming into your home, if you're going into someone else's home. So if you come in contact or think you may be at risk, then just communicate that. Let us know. You know, share with us if you need help with something. We can steer you in the right direction or give you the advice that we think is best, especially me as a nurse, but I also have health services. So Boston Public Schools has the umbrella of health services that does all the contact tracing. There's a case in the school. Health services does contact tracing. They're also a huge resource for testing centers, just on how long do you quarantine, how long do you isolate, all that. I can connect, any nurse in Boston Public Schools can connect you with them to give you that advice. I mean, number one absolute is just communication and mask wearing and just, you know, social distancing, mask wearing, vaccines. Those are all the kind of ventilation, your top mitigation strategies. But communication feels like just number one.
And what do you most want out of this school year? What are you most looking forward to?
You know, I hope that we can somehow balance having education happen in person and dealing with COVID maybe on a day-to-day basis in the buildings, you know, but being able to have kids here and develop the right kind of strategies that are possible with what we've got to have them in the building. I think the perfect balance would be kids in person, COVID still ongoing, a lot less positives, a lot less transmission. If we could somehow get there, I think that would be amazing.
All right, that is Marta Bosmer. She is a registered nurse and a school nurse at Boston Green Academy, which is a high school in Brighton, actually grades 6 through 12. Marta, thank you so much.
Tiziana, thank you.
So WBUR education reporter Carrie Young is still with us. Carrie, your reactions to what we just heard from Marta.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that struck me, I think, was her last comment about one of the most important mitigation strategies this year is going to be communication. And that struck a chord with me because I remember hearing that from both teachers and parents, and even students last year for that matter, just because, you know, when people feel like they're in the dark or having to seek information, you know, maybe they're finding it in the most, maybe not the most trustworthy of sources. Whereas if the information's flowing all the time and pretty regularly, it's a trusted source, you know, that just helps. And also, you know, just the importance of balancing both mental health and also your physical health, because COVID, like Marta said, really impacts everything in your life.
And Carrie, lastly, what is success this year? You know, what are teachers, administrators saying a successful school year looks like by the time June rolls around?
You know, if you had asked me that back in April or May last school year, I would have said that the metric of success might be how well schools caught kids up from the previous year and a half of disruption and hybrid learning. But with this Delta variant, I think how well districts are keeping the disease from spreading out of control is going to be one of the biggest metrics of success this year, you know, in addition to how we're catching kids up. I guess we're just adding to that some things we weren't expecting.
All right. That is WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, great to have you. Thanks so much.
Always happy to be here. Thanks.
You have come to know retired federal judge Nancy Gertner here on the show over the years. We turn to her to help us comb out all things legal and to be our guide through the morass that can sometimes be the criminal justice system. Well, it turns out she has been struggling with some legal demons herself, and she wound up turning to people she'd sentenced to help her sort them out. She tells that story in her upcoming book, Incomplete Sentences. We caught up with Judge Gertner the other day, and I began by asking her if, by telling her own story, she's hoping to right some of the decisions she now feels were wrong.
These are wrongs that I can't right because this was, I write about the people I sentenced in a 17-year career. But I think it was, I thought it was important that people understood what these narratives were like, who these people were, and how little we paid attention to the details of their lives. I thought that was important. We talk about criminal justice issues, mass incarceration, racial disparities, and we do all of that in the abstract. But I wanted to describe concretely what it was like to be a judge, to sentence someone to a sentence which I believe to have been unfair, and what that was like, and what we can do about it now going forward.
And you felt it was unfair a lot of the time.
Well, I think it's fair to say I was a judge from 1994 to 2011. And for half of that time, even more than half, that we had mandatory, well, we still have mandatory minimum sentences. So you'd find yourself sentencing, one man comes to mind, who began dealing drugs for school supplies for his siblings. And so by the time he continued dealing drugs until his 20s, he hadn't graduated high school, he winds up with a record. It's not a substantial record, but it's a record that triggered a 10-year mandatory minimum. And so I had to sentence him to a 10-year mandatory minimum, even though that was wildly disproportionate to any fair and just sentence. And so I write about what that's like, what I knew then. And then he's one of the people that reached out to me after I left the bench to talk.
So let's talk about that. You talk in some of your writing about this note on Facebook Messenger that changes right. your direction here and starts you in engaging with men you had sentenced. Tell us
Well,
about
I have
that.
A confession to make. So I had no idea what Facebook Messenger was, right? I mean, I play around with the technology, but I had no idea what I was doing. And literally one day, playing around with it, and I get a message. And the message says, "Is this Judge Gertner?" And you know, this is, and he mentions his name, and I knew exactly who he was. He was facing, actually murder charges, was facing a potential death penalty, was acquitted. He said, told me that I was important in his life, and he, wanted to make sure that I was okay. I didn't know what to do, right? You could write back and say, "No, you got the wrong Judge Gertner. I'm sorry, goodbye." Or you could say, "Actually, I remember you. This is the I am the judge who sentenced you. What's going on in your life?" And that started a conversation both online and in person, which made an enormous difference to me. What it had been like to be facing the kinds of charges he was facing, how his life, he wound up doing some time on another charge, how his life's changed, and what he's doing now. And then that opened the door. Once I realized that I could do that and it was really, I thought, important to do, I reached out to one or two other of the men I've sentenced, and they reached out to others, and I started getting calls from a whole lot of people. And it was a very moving experience, because I learned it was even worse than I had imagined. In other words, I knew that there was a disconnect between what I knew about these men and how I had to treat them. And the disconnect was even more dramatic when I learned about parts of their lives that I never knew and that no one knew. I'm not sure that their lawyers knew.
And yet you found what, in my head, when I read what you wrote about, my words again, the kindness, the forgiveness, again, my words, that you encountered in these men when you met with them in coffee shops and federal court buildings and in different locations, it struck me that you were encountering grace. And that was really surprising.
Well, it's interesting. You can say I was encountering grace, but there's actually another lesson to learn from that, which is, in one sense, they expected, jail was a normal aspect of their lives. They were not indignant. I was indignant. They were not. And they were not indignant at the schools that failed them, at the social services that failed them. I was indignant in hearing their stories. So, for example, Tiziana, one thing I found was, you know, they all had dropped out of school. I inquired about the school. This I learned after I left the bench. And the school had lost its accreditation. Numbers of them would describe to me about going into school in the morning, checking in, and then leaving, and nobody noticed. So they were not angry at that. I'd listen to these stories and go, "My God, how did all this happen?" They were not angry. So yes, on the one hand, it was grace, but on the other hand, there was a certain sense that we had made imprisonment normal, and they were not mad about it.
So we know from historical study of sentencing guidelines that they disproportionately affect Black and brown men. As you have reflected, and you have spoken openly with me on the air here before about being aware as a white woman of the way race is affected by and affects systemic inequalities in our criminal justice system. How have you thought about race as you've engaged in this process and reflected for yourself?
Well, I thought that I understood what was going on when I was a judge. I thought I did, because I had been a criminal defense lawyer, I'd been a civil rights lawyer, but I didn't realize what distance from these communities had, how much that had colored my view. Really, finding out about schools in communities of color, unlike any school you would find anywhere else in the city. The proliferation of charges against these men at a time when, partly when they were adolescents, but certainly between 18 and 21, when the charges that they would amass were, as at least in large measure, in my view, because of policing in their neighborhoods. Then there was they were all labeled gang members in this particular group. And, you know, the gang could as, the gang affiliation derived from the block they lived on. And they told me you couldn't get in the gang, you couldn't get out of the gang. It's simply where you lived. The description of these men included their aliases. And the aliases, you know, sort of hinted darkly at some hierarchical
the description
theme.
In their records.
Right, their aliases. Their aliases were childhood nicknames that they had given one another. One woman talked about, you know, they basically had been together in Pampers. So but they come into my court, you know, as the prototype of the predator, you know, the dangerous gang. And surely there was danger there, but we had so taken this out of proportion that we could no longer see the individuals that we were sentencing.
So you have started this path of reflection, so I feel comfortable asking you this hard question. Should you have known some of that while you were a federal judge?
Oh, well, yes, I should have known it for part of the period of time. You know, I'm not sure what we could have done about it except to say it out loud. In other words, in the case of the man I was telling you about who started dealing drugs for school supplies, I sentenced him to 10 years. I had no choice. But I wrote an opinion saying this is wrong. And I think had I known what I know now, I would have written many, many more opinions like that. This is wrong. We were not allowed under the federal sentencing guidelines to take into account someone's substance abuse history. And yet, nothing is more relevant to recidivism, nothing is more relevant to rehabilitation than that, but this guideline said they are not ordinarily relevant. So I knew some of it because we had good probation officers, but to know the extent of it was chilling. You know, the numbers of men in this group who were either victims of witnesses to or perpetrators of violence, and sometimes all three, was extraordinary. So during much of this period of time, my hands were tied by mandatory guidelines and mandatory minimums. But still, there's stuff I could have said, even more than I said, to make people aware of precisely how grotesque this system of sentencing was.
In your excerpted essay that I read about the book, I found myself thinking about a segment we did a couple months ago with Taya Miles. She wrote a book called All That She Carried, where she traces the history of a flour sack that was given into an enslaved girl by her mother. And much of the book underscores what we don't know about the detailed history of those who were enslaved, other than their enslavement. And you talk about, and you've mentioned a little bit here, going back through records, and the only thing you can find out about the men you sentenced were what they did wrong.
Right.
Is everything about our framing as we go into even the criminal justice process missing key pieces that we need to do differently?
Absolutely. You know, there have been many people now in connection with the 1619 Project of the New York Times, in connection with Black Lives Matter, who talk about the function of the criminal justice system in enforcing black codes, in undoing whatever gains had come from the civil rights movement. Imprisonment and the criminal justice system was really part and parcel of a way of keeping black people down then. And then there are many who believe it still is. So, you know, it's sort of different levels of knowing. There's knowing that could have affected what I did. There's knowing that could have affected my analysis of what I did, my criticism of what I did. And then there's knowing that should affect how we deal with the system going forward and how we address the system going forward.
I imagine the listener who's saying the criminal justice system is designed to be punitive, to bring justice when people commit crimes, and that's legitimate too. I know there are listeners who are thinking that as we have this conversation. What is your answer to them, given the case that you're making right now?
First of all, many of the people I'm talking about are dealing with drug cases, not violent cases. Some were violent, but most of the overwhelming number were drug cases. And while punishment may be appropriate, the question is disproportionate punishment, punishment that essentially sets these men and these communities back decades. We're talking about proportionality here. Before the federal system changed, 50% of people would get probation for relatively minor drug offenses. After mandatory guidelines, it was like 2 or 3 or 4 or 5% would get probation. And yet some of these men didn't need more than sort of, you know, writing their path. So one can say, who cares, right? The disproportionate punishment, they were still off the street. Well, one thing is that it really had very limited relationship to the crime rate. We've learned that now. We simply destroyed families, children, created the possibility of even intergenerational stories. The men that I talked to were used to being in prison because everyone around them was used to, was expecting men between 18 and 27 to be imprisoned. So imprisonment not being a deterrent, imprisonment just destroyed lives. We're really not, one of the reasons I want to write this book is that we talk about the wrongfully convicted, and we talk rightfully about victims. These are people who probably, it was right to convict them. The question is what the punishment that we imposed and whether it bore any relationship to a rational criminal justice system. And in my view, it didn't.
So last question for you, and again, I know this is a hard question. I believe that part of the burden of authority, I think, is the regret that you live with over your mistakes, because those mistakes have consequences for other people. Is there any atonement for you that you want to do, have done, feel like you want to do as you've gone through this reckoning for yourself?
Atonement isn't the right word. Reckoning is the word. Being accountable is the right word. Judges are, you know, accountable to the Court of Appeals that reverses them, to their caseload. I wanted to be accountable to the problem, to try to understand the problem and my role in it. And hopefully this book will be part of that mission, and maybe we'll avoid some of these mistakes going forward.
That was retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. Her upcoming book is Incomplete Sentences. The Red Sox have a game tonight against the Tampa Bay Rays, assuming they can find enough players. The team has been devastated by a COVID-19 outbreak in recent days. On Tuesday, shortstop Xander Bogaerts had to be pulled in the second inning after getting a positive COVID test. The team has now had 11 players and staff members test positive since last Friday. Why are they still playing their games, you ask? Good question. And
it's all right, Titi. I'm a shortstop. I can jump right in. I got my glove ready to go.
You wish, Chris Sitterick. Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick there, and we're going to check the score, and not just on that, Chris, but if that weren't enough to talk about, big news from the Patriots this week. They released quarterback Cam Newton, who most expected would begin the season as the starter. Lots to check the score on, Chris.
Absolutely, and you can count me as those who expected him to start as the starter.
I know.
Week 9 would be the switch.
Yeah, you were kind of wrong on that. So we brought a friend today. Also here, Kyrie Thompson, sports writer for Boston.com. Hey, Kyrie, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It is great to be back.
Great to have you. I want to invite listeners to join this conversation, whether you want to weigh in on the Red Sox's COVID struggles or the now seemingly resolved quarterback competition at Gillette. Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Kyrie, I'm going to start with you because Chris has been telling us all week that this Patriots decision to release Cam Newton is huge. I know you covered the training camp for the Patriots. I followed you on Twitter. How surprised were you to see this decision? And, you know, one of my favorite questions, how big a deal is this, Kyrie?
Well, I would say I'm not terribly surprised. I mean, I think that for a while there, I was also in the camp that I thought that perhaps he would start the season as the quarterback, but that the switch would come relatively soon. Of course, Bill Belichick just decided to cut out the middleman and get straight to it, which I think is perhaps unlike the reputation he has. You know, I kept on hearing that He would never start a rookie. He's never done that before. I mean, especially when it comes to the quarterback position, he never had to do that because he had Tom Brady and he just was here for 20 years. But I think that it is a big deal because for one thing, you're removing Cam Newton, who is, you know, for all of his struggles last year, who he's a known commodity, star power, and he's very magnetic. The guys in the the guys in the locker room really, really like him and gravitate towards him. But they thought that the rookie was better. And from my eyes, the rookie was better. It wasn't necessarily that Cam Newton was bad. I mean, this kid just was better than advertised. Yeah, Mac Jones.
Sorry, just telling folks Mac Jones is the kid you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. Mac Jones was better than advertised. I think that even the Patriots were somewhat surprised by how quickly he picked things up. And really, he just looks like a New England Patriots quarterback out there, way more than Cam Newton does. So, yeah, I would say that this is a pretty interesting deal. And, of course, that also sets up a matchup in Week 4 where you're going to see the new versus the old when the Patriots play the Buccaneers. So that'll be really interesting. Circle that one on your calendars again.
Yeah, that will be very interesting. So Chris, you know, we have this ongoing project where we are talking about sports here on a public radio station. Not all of our listeners are sports fans. The sports is fascinating on this one, and even non-sports fans are paying attention. But also, this feels like it might have been an intersection with COVID, although the Patriots not saying that.
Yeah, Bill Belichick made it clear that, or at least said that was not a factor here. Cam Newton is unvaccinated and had to miss 5 days towards the end of the preseason because he missed a test. And unvaccinated players have to be tested every single day. Bill kind of has to say that that's not a factor because they're not allowed to make personnel decisions based on vaccination status. And Urban Meyer in Jacksonville is actually under investigation right now for comments kind of along those lines. So Belichick didn't really have a choice but to say that it wasn't a factor. But we know Bill Belichick, above all else, is a competitor. And he looks for competitive advantage anywhere and everywhere he can. And I think it's fair to assume that on some level, I'm not saying this was the clinching factor, but knowing that you have a guy on the roster that could potentially be removed from your team for a week or longer as the season goes along, I'm sure Belichick saw that as a net negative for the team, and that had to be part of this decision here.
1-800-423-8255 to share your thoughts on that decision. Was this about football? Was it about COVID? Bit of both? Share your thoughts with us. I want to stay on this vaccination question, Kyrie. Bill Belichick was asked about whether vaccination status played into the decision. It was kind of a testy exchange. Here is a bit of him responding to a question from Boston Globe senior NFL writer Ben Volen.
We've had minimal, but throughout the league, there have been a number of, quite a high number, I would say, of players who have, you know, had the virus who have been vaccinated. So your implication that vaccination solves every problem is just not really, I would say that has not been substantiated based on what's happened in training camp this year.
So, Kyrie, first I want to note, we covered this in Ask the Doctors yesterday, the breakthrough infection rate among vaccinated people in the Commonwealth is a fraction of a percent. Still, that caused some double and triple takes. You were there. What was your reaction to hearing that live?
Honestly, I found it to be a bit surprising and frankly a bit disappointing. Now, I'll say this. There's a little bit of context here. First of all, this isn't even the first time he said this in the past week. He said it to the media when kind of first addressing Cam Newton's absence, from joint practices when we got to ask him about it. And he said that, and I noted it at the time and thought it was strange. And then he says it again. Now, in particular, in talking with Ben Volen, I think that there's also a bit of context here where Ben Volen wrote a column about Cam Newton and basically urging him to get vaccinated for this exact reason that, like, hey, if you don't get vaccinated, you might be at risk of losing your job for situations exactly like the one that just unfolded. He didn't even test positive for COVID. He just, you know, had an issue with the testing protocol and had to be out for 5 days. The Patriots got a chance to look at his replacement and were like, oh, I think we're pretty good with this. I think this confirms what we want to see. The thing that disappointed me about the Belichick comment, you know, quite frankly, is that it's not the defense that he thinks it is. For one thing, you know, even if you're saying that he's trying to just take the heat off of Cam Newton and, you know, doesn't want to admit that, you know, if it was a factor, he doesn't want to admit it. Bringing up breakthrough cases when, as far as we know, the unvaccinated players have tested positive for COVID-19. It's seven times the clip as vaccinated players and staff. So why would you not bring that up if you're going to make that comparison? So I don't really think that there was a big point in bringing that up. I think that what really happened there is he showed us a bit more of how he views the NFL's protocols than perhaps he intended. I think that for one thing, the Patriots, it sounded like there was some frustration coming from the building about Newton's situation. Just maybe not even necessarily like whose fault was it? You know, did Cam, you know, screw something up? It's basically just like, why do we have to deal with this? Why can't we just focus on football? Why are you not vaccinated? I think was kind of the edge there. And so I think that Belichick, you know, regardless of his personal feelings about vaccination or whatever, which we don't know, right? I think that he finds it a nuisance and he really doesn't want to have to keep answering these questions.
But so let me just jump over to Chris on that, because I'm going to come back to you in a second. Chris, you may recall that a couple of weeks ago on Week in Review, we had two guests on who had previously been Patriots fans who both declared that they were frustrated enough with Bill Belichick to be done with him. And it was on things like not acting like a public leader, right, in moments when information would be helpful. Is there a dereliction of duty here with those kinds of messages from Belichick, just briefly?
I would say yes, but also it's never been there over his 20-plus years here. Like, he's never been a quote-unquote public leader. He's a guy who's there to do football, and he hates anything that takes any focus away from on-the-field football. And I think that's kind of what he was trying to do with his answer there. I would echo Kyrie and say he's missing the really important context that, as Kyrie said, seven times higher infection rate among unvaccinated players than vaccinated. So it's not – I think it's irresponsible to dismiss the efficiency, the efficacy of the vaccines, especially as someone who is in the spotlight. But does Bill Belichick consider himself a public leader? I would say absolutely not. He considers himself a football coach.
Exactly.
All right, I want to get to vaccines and sports more with the Red Sox, so let's leave some time for that. So, but briefly, before we go from this, Kyrie, you have been covering the Pats. You've been there. It is not lost on me that this is a black quarterback being replaced by a white quarterback who is a quote-unquote Patriots fit, right? Or maybe not quote-unquote, but that's sort of the general conversation. There is a strong football dimension here, but I gotta admit, I can't help about thinking about the Jeopardy tweet recently that LeVar Burton wasn't a good fit for Jeopardy. What is the conversation in the NFL about whether there's a racial dimension to this?
I feel like there's always going to be that kind of, you know, if you know, you know, sort of thought about it. And I've seen it floating around from your media personalities. I think that the benefit of the doubt isn't quite as strong for Cam Newton here, partly because of the vaccination part. So people are kind of like, hey, you kind of cost yourself here. I'll say this, though, in regards to recent comments made by, you know, somebody on 98.5, the Sports Hub, Scott Zolak, who was basically calling out Cam Newton for dancing to rap music during practice and being like, the Patriots need to turn off the rap music.
How dare you know, you have fun while you're playing a game?
Because it's distracting him. And then the juxtaposition of Mac Jones looks like he's there to work. And, you know, Cam Newton's just there to play around. That kind of stuff, you can't deny that, you know, to certain people, I think there is a slight undercurrent of Mac Jones looks like he's a Patriots quarterback. Cam Newton does not. He doesn't look anything like what the Patriots have started at quarterback for the last, you know, for much of their history, and definitely not the last 20 years. And I think that it's unfortunate, you know, that it kind of ends this way, because Cam Newton came in last year and put up with a lot of stuff, and he wasn't, you know, fully healthy and stuff. He just came out and performed on pure skill and did the best he could. I mean, he got beat out by somebody who was better this year, but, you know, I think that it was more performance-based than anything. But yeah, I do look at some of the things that people have said about him, the way that he's been perceived here, and that you know, undercurrent of a black quarterback in a still very kind of white centric position definitely still rings with me.
All right. I do want to leave a little time for the Red Sox here. Chris, 11 players and our staff test positive since last Friday. And then a player, not just any player, Xander Bogaerts, pulled mid-game on Tuesday night. First, what? And how unusual is that?
I mean, it's pretty unusual, except in the time of COVID where it's happened before. But I have to say, I think Dennis Eckersley, who does color commentary for the Sox, put it absolutely best when it actually happened on Tuesday night.
Well, that news just knocks your socks off, doesn't it?
Love me some Eck. The Sox are really struggling here. 23 of the major league teams have at least 85% of their players and staff vaccinated. The Sox are not one of those teams. They're one of seven that have not hit that threshold. And we don't actually know what percentage of players, tier one personnel, they're called, players and staff that have kind of direct contact are vaccinated. So this is a problem. Chaim Bloom called it gut-wrenching. They are really struggling with this, and man, has this team fallen. July 28th, they were first place in the AL East, 63-40 on the year. They've been 13-19 since, and they are barely clinging to the playoffs right now. This is really making an impact for them.
So, Kyrie, football and baseball, both businesses. We've talked here on the show in the past about the strong protocols around vaccination and expectations in the NFL. Does somebody need to be accountable on the Red Sox leadership and management when 11 players are out and they run the risk of not being able to play a game?
I mean, the answer I would say is yes. And I think that needs to come from the top, and it needs to come from Alex Cora. I think what you're hearing from Alex Cora as he talks about it in the media, or Chaim Bloom when he's talking about it to the media, is they feel like they're kind of at wit's end here. Because, I mean, they've both said they're both vaccinated. They seem to be pushing for it. They've had medical experts come in and talk about it. But they can't force the players to do this. You know, they can't force the players to trust the information. And I feel like, to an extent, right, from a legal standpoint, there are limited things that they can do to, you know, kind of, you know, push it harder or punish people that aren't getting vaccinated. We're already seeing, as Chris mentioned, investigations happening in the NFL about it. At the same time, it's like the competitive advantages that come with this. The NFL's made it clear, we want you to do this. And if you're not going to do it, then there are consequences.
Yep. All right. That is Kyrie Thompson, sports writer for Boston.com, Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick. Kyrie, thanks.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me.
Great to have you. And Chris, always good to have you too. We'll do it again.
Great to be with you both.
All right, folks, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.